JM in the AM on a Wednesday. Today's Wednesday. You know how I know? Because I'm constantly reminded that we're 6 days away from election day. So Tuesday would be election day. 6 days before would be a Wednesday. And here we are, in fact. 6 days before decision day here in the United States. And it is with great pleasure that we welcome to the airwaves someone who has this incredible ability to analyze elections and other news items. Political and economic commentator, longtime news and television producer, and now can be found on Substack, jakenovak.substack.com. The one and only Jake Novak with us live via telephone. Good morning. A pleasure to welcome you back to JM in the AM.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that wonderful intro. Thank you so much.
Certainly. You've mentioned Yeshiva Flatbush and your past in the past on this show. And, of course, we just announced a few minutes ago that Rabbi Raymond Harari passed away. And I figured it would only be appropriate for you to take a minute at the beginning of this conversation just to give us a snapshot, if that's possible, of a brilliant decades-long career in Jewish education.
Yeah, I can. Obviously, sad news this morning. Well, first of all, Rabbi Harari was my first Chumash teacher in high school, and I still remember our very first lesson. How about that for a compliment to him and his memory? We learned the Rashi by Yisu Mi Refidim. It just jumped into the deep end there. Many of your listeners may know that the emphasis at Yeshiva Flatbush has always been on Tanakh. We had a double period of Gemara too, but we had probably about four periods of Chumash and Tanakh and Nevi'im every day, on average as well.
Right.
And of course, the philosophy was that now that we have the State of Israel, and of course, Flatbush's other main key goal was Hebrew fluency. If you didn't learn Hebrew fluently at Flatbush, you weren't graduating. It was as simple as that. You wouldn't make it, actually.
Wow.
So their philosophy was, why not emphasize the Tanakh, especially the geography of the Tanakh, the cadence of the Tanakh, and then with the realization that you could actually go visit these places if you wanted to now and do those kinds of things. So of course he was fully on board with that. This was this was something that he helped to implement from the people who created it. And the other thing that people need to understand, I think that a PhD thesis could be written about this. Rabbi Harari was a young student at the Yeshiva Flatbush, in addition to being a member of the faculty. He graduated the high school class in 1972. And when he started going to the school in the late 60s, the administration, Joel Braverman and Rabbi Eliach at Flatbush, basically saw that this was the demographics of the neighborhood was going. There were a lot more Syrian Jews, Egyptian Jews, Jews from Arab lands coming into the community. And they did not have their own rabbis for the most part. They were not as immersed in scholarship and Jewish traditional life like as it was in other parts of the diaspora. And they really saw this young man as being potentially not only a great student, but someone who could be a leader. They convinced him to go to Yeshiva University, get his smicha. And he is an interesting story of understanding demographics within your demographic. I mean, you have to be a Jew to understand that we're the most diverse people, even when we're all Jews in the room.
Right.
And Flatbush realized that, and they realized that they needed to have some of these Syrian Jews be rabbis and also be leaders in the community. And he was a project for them that paid off in many, many, many ways. Obviously, it's sad to hear of his passing, but his legacy at Flatbush is you walk into the school and the legacy is there. I mean, it is a bastion of where the Sephardic community in New York and Los Angeles have gone to being much more observant than it was, much more scholarly than it was. And very, very sad that he passed, but his legacy will live on for a long time. And the story I just told you, a lot of people don't know, so I'm glad that I'm getting it out there.
Look, anybody who's had even a casual relationship with the Yeshiva Flatbush, like we've had over all these years, certainly appreciated and understood the leadership and the great qualities and the talent of Rabbi Harari. It's as simple as that. Again, anybody even familiar remotely with the Flatbush, Yeshiva Flatbush community, certainly had heard of him and heard of his reputation over the years. So with sadness, we mentioned that Rabbi Dr. Raymond Harari has passed away. Funeral later today at the Yeshiva Flatbush High School, and our condolences to his family and, of course, the entire Yeshiva Flatbush community. Jake Novak's with us. We promised you some election analysis. The election is officially 6 days away, although many people listening right now in the New York, New Jersey area and in the United States may have voted already because early voting has started in states that have early voting. Jake, I don't know what you think of the run-up to this election. It's been a very interesting last couple of weeks and certainly a very interesting last couple of days. I don't recall, and again, you know, sometimes memory is selective. You may say to me that Reagan Carter was just as ugly in the last days before the election. I just don't remember. But it does seem that the name calling and the terminology that's being used and the rhetoric that's being mentioned from the podiums during the last week, it seems a bit over the top. Would you say both campaigns have gotten into areas that previous campaigns have not?
Oh, well, that goes without saying. You know, when I was a television news producer for 30 years, one of the rules I had for my writers was if I see the word unprecedented or first time ever in your scripts, you're out, because it almost always has happened before. But in this case, you know, we've literally had nastier things said about different candidates, but not by the candidates themselves.
The
nastiest campaign in American history remains the presidential election of 1800. The supporters of Jefferson and the supporters of John Adams did not spare a thing. But the candidates themselves never said any of these things publicly, but they obviously didn't have television or radio back then, and they didn't write them personally. So, but now you have obviously one candidate comparing, you know, we have Kamala Harris from her own mouth comparing Donald Trump to Nazis and the rest. And you have Donald Trump with his usual kind of insult parade, which is really not anything new. The one thing I will say is that actually, if you really pay attention, Donald Trump has been much more restrained in this campaign. And I think it's one of the things that's really helping him in the polls. You know, our current controversy is that a comedian who spoke hours before Trump actually spoke at this rally in Madison Square Garden told an inappropriate joke or a joke that didn't work.
An insulting joke.
The fact that we're not talking about something he said is a big step.
Right.
But no, you're absolutely right. We're in a new place, and it's a dangerous place. It's a dangerous place, and one that I'm very worried about post-election day violence, because I believe that the Harris campaign and Kamala Harris making that accusation is not Nahum about changing the minds of the viewers. That's the voters. I think it's about getting them crazed and ready for post-election violence.
So when you say that you have a fear for post-election violence, you're saying no matter who wins and no matter which side, meaning anybody in this country of any political background, you think could be revved up to the point where they would act violently.
Yeah. I've been on record since June 27th of saying that Donald Trump is going to win this election. So
have you changed at all?
It's funny. I predicted
because I said the Yankees would win in six. I have no choice. I have to change my prediction.
Yeah, you've got to change that. You know, what people need to understand is I actually believe the polls now are basically just reverting to telling the truth that's been the truth since June 27th. Why did the polls switch in Kamala's favor for 7-8 weeks or so? Because that's the insertion of a new name. And let's be honest, if you go outside of D.C. and go to a public place and ask 10 people who the vice president was on June 26th, 8 would not know.
Right.
And to insert a new name like that.
Sadly, you're right.
Right. And if you insert a new name into an election like that, you get something called statistical noise. People don't know who the person is. They basically put on hold what they say publicly, even though they made the decision. As soon as Joe Biden dropped out of the race, as soon as he had that horrific debate performance on June 27th, which, by the way, wasn't even in the top 10 of his bad performances of the whole year. So it was the media hype about it that took him down, not just his bad performance. I think that the election was unwinnable for the Democrats. I think that some people got caught up in the new name hype, including some Democrats themselves. But now we're back to the reality of you have a major party, Nahum, that eliminated their candidate as late as July.
Right. The chances to win are zero. And I hear this, and I understand that, you know, someone like yourself who made a prediction that you're sticking with, I understand why you think that will be the result. However, let's just do the math for a moment. You study the maps like everybody else does, and I can imagine how you're going to be poring over them as the results come in on Tuesday night. He has to win, and by the way, if you disagree with this statement, you got to let me know. He has to win 7 swing states to have a shot at the presidency. True or false?
No, he doesn't need to win all of them. He basically needs to win. I mean, there's 7 swing states, so I'll tell you the ones he needs to win. He needs Arizona, North Carolina,
Pennsylvania,
and one, just one, of Michigan, Wisconsin, or Pennsylvania.
He could win. He could win this election with only three swing states.
Well, he doesn't. He would have to not lose. I mean, the seven swing states are. Let's count them off: Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Georgia. I've got five.
Nevada.
And the last one is North Carolina. Okay. So if he wins North Carolina, now in 2016, he won North Carolina. Of those seven states that I just mentioned, he did not win Nevada. So he won North Carolina, Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And he had 306 electoral votes. So he had 36 to spare.
Right. That's true.
So he can't lose if he wins one of those, what we call blue wall states.
Right. Right. That's
and
true.
doesn't lose North Carolina and Georgia, then he's got it. He's got it.
So he could win three swing states and win the election.
Yeah. If he wins the right three. That's correct.
If he wins the right three, right. If he wins the right three, then he wins the election. By the way, what do you make of the Amit Segal had this out of Israel. What do you make of this poll in Israel? That he's as popular as he is, that, you know, if all Israelis were allowed to vote in the American election, he'd get 90% of that vote. To me, it doesn't make sense unless they're really, you know, unless they're polling people on one issue, which is his attitude towards Israel's security. Otherwise, politically, he does not line up with a large portion of Israel's population.
Well, I think that you know, Israelis are as, and we Jews are just as susceptible to political nonsense. You know, we are not immune to all that kind of stuff. But I do think that Israelis are much more focused on policy when it comes to foreign leaders.
Right.
In other words, I think that if Israelis were focused on policy alone, we wouldn't be having all these close elections in Israel.
Right. Good
but
point.
That's their person.
Right.
When it's not the person that they seem to be much more wise and removed emotionally from the choice. But I don't think that any person, I don't think that's unique of Israelis. I think that it's when it's your own country and your own person, emotions really rule the day.
Jake Novak's with us. All right. So you're sticking by your prediction. I don't think you're predicting which of the seven swing states he'll win, but it certainly looks like, I mean, you know, it's funny. We all become, you know, victims. I'll put it that way. Of the mass media. I mean, you know, unfortunately, and I hate to use the word brainwashing, but that's, you know, very often that's what's happening when the mass media gets behind a certain point of view or certain narrative. It is interesting to me that even the mass media is discussing how well he's doing in Pennsylvania. And I don't want to say they're resigned to the fact that he's going to win Pennsylvania. Obviously, Shapiro is very popular, and I'm sure there's plenty of Democratic outposts that are, you know, very strong in the state. But to me, it's the only thing that they're giving in on. It's the only thing they're actually acknowledging that he's doing better there than we thought he would.
Well, that's a big thing to give up because Pennsylvania is the key swing state. I mean, yes, you can break it down to seven states, and they aren't as interconnected. You know, elections aren't as much of a wave as they used to be. Used to be, you know, think about the elections that you and I grew up in 1980, 84, right. 88. Elections used to be, if you could look at a state like Ohio,
right.
As recently as really even 2016, and realize no one was losing an election if they won Ohio,
right.
Especially. That's not so true anymore. However, I really think it all comes down to Pennsylvania. If Trump either wins Pennsylvania or it's within a fraction there, then he's going to win enough elsewhere.
Right.
And for them to concede that he's doing well there really sounds to me like a concession of the election overall. If they can't win Pennsylvania, where President Biden grew up, where they have so much effort, where they are now focusing even more effort because they pulled all their ad spending out of North Carolina. Kamala Harris did that yesterday, $2 million. Then they've lost the election.
What do you think of Fetterman's honesty? It's pretty interesting. It's nice to see an honest politician. He's obviously endorsing and campaigning for Harris. At the same time, he's acknowledging that he sees plenty of people in his state going, you know, MAGA crazy for Trump. And I thought that was, you know, it's nice to have an honest perspective once in a while from these guys.
Yeah, let's see what happens when the election's over. Will he be the new Joe Manchin in the Senate, the one who is a swing Democrat who votes?
Right.
Will he switch parties?
Especially on foreign policy issues.
Right. Will he be a target of, I call them the regressives, the AOC far left part of the party, you know, who want to regress back to communism and anti-Semitism, two of the oldest movements of all time. Calling them progressives is really a misnomer. They are regressive. Let's see if he's a major target. You know, for the regressive wing of the party, this election is a no-lose scenario. Either they win the White House, either their party wins the White House, or it loses and they can make the claim, well, now it's time for us to take over this party because you guys are losers. So let's see what happens with him. But obviously, you know, listen, there are a number of people throughout the recent history who we don't agree with, or I don't agree with on a lot of policy stuff, but they're great on Israel and foreign policy. And that's enough. That's the big tent. I'm willing to, you know, accept. But let's see where he goes. Let's see where he goes. I definitely think he'll be targeted one way or the other in a both positive and negative way.
You know, another big difference between now and 1980 and 1984. Now you can't go to sleep at 10 o'clock Tuesday night. then you could have.
We should be able to, because we certainly have the ability to do that. But now it has a lot to do with these election shenanigans and states that deliberately don't start counting absentee ballots until others are counted. I mean, horrific, horrific stuff that really is a tremendous threat to the integrity of the elections that is all within – very easily could be changed. And it's only being done to – out of chicanery, out of ways thinking about trying to cheat, or if the election is close enough, dragging it out.
Look,
it's a terrible tradition.
The bottom line is, anybody who's skeptical about what you're saying, think about the fact you don't have to show an ID to vote. That just starts right there. I mean, that's just the basic, you know, you don't have to identify yourself in order to actually vote in an election, which is outrageous in my opinion. But I think that just you know, that it all starts there. And then, of course, as you just suggested, it sprouts forth from that point. I got to ask you one question about the local stuff. Any surprise, especially with the AOC and quote unquote progressives and their, you know, chomping at the bit to take over New York City? Any surprise that Mayor Adams went ahead and sort of defended Donald Trump with the whole fascist moniker and all that, and put himself in a position where now anybody on the far left has no interest in him continuing to be mayor of the city?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely, I feel now he will certainly not run next year. Right. I mean, that's one thing. And that was probably true before he defended Donald Trump and calling and saying he isn't a fascist. I think it's too little too late for him. This is a person who has said a number of good things during his time as mayor and done very little to back it up. And it's and it's a big head scratcher for me, because if he had done something about it, he would have had a tremendous boost in his polls. If he had done more than complain about the crime and actually called on Governor Hochul to remove Alvin Bragg as DA, his poll numbers would be through the roof.
Right.
If he had said, I want the border closed, his poll numbers would be through the roof. And actually, it's funny that I'm saying this, because he actually wouldn't have had to done that all that much.
Right.
He would have had to stand on that. So I'm actually going to call that an action, even though that's mostly a statement. So he didn't do those things. I don't understand why.
Well, I would assume fear of criticism in the press and fear of more indictments, I would guess.
Yes, I guess. But I think that has a lot to do with the fact that today's politicians have central office management. You know, it's funny, you know, you talk about like how everyone, and you know, we all like to find our own shul and our own rabbi. I think most people hate central office religion. I hate that more a lot, but I also hate central office politics. And I think that almost every elected Democrat in America now has a central office DNC appointed staff who work for the DNC and not for the individual. And, you know, in politics, as it is in capitalism, compassionate but selfish self-interest is how you get things done. You know, Mayor Koch was successful in the city because he marched to his own drummer. Rudy Giuliani, when he was mayor, marched to his own drummer. The best politicians do that. The most successful politicians do that. They're not just part of a collective. That's what they had in the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union had it better than us, Nachum, because at least the members of the Politburo were named and publicly known. I don't know who's running the White House right now. I don't know all the names. I got some ideas.
And you also,
but I would like to know the name of the people running the country.
And you also don't know the names of the people who are plotting who will be the next leaders in New York City, frankly.
Yeah, right. You don't. And that's really quite frightening. I mean, really, even the Soviet Union, people of the Soviet Union, that horrible regime, knew the names of the darn supporters, the people who in the Politburo, who was running the White House. I write every day on my Twitter X feed. It's October 30th. I've been doing this for more than a month, and we don't know who the president is.
Right.
How on earth is that allowed? I mean, there's no way that Joe Biden is in charge. Nobody thinks that.
1 week from today, Jake Novak's going to join us. I don't know if we'll have any real results by then on Wednesday morning, but who knows? Maybe there will be a trend that we can start talking about in terms of who's winning election 2024. Jake, I thank you. Have you voted yet, or you're one of those traditionalists who waits till Tuesday?
I'm trying to decide. I have very little excuse because literally the voting place is this shoal right next to my house. So I got... I probably will vote early, maybe not until
this will be the first time that I vote early, only because I have a crazy schedule next Tuesday. But and also the lines, I think, are going to be is in 2020 the lines were so long on Tuesday election day. I'd like to avoid that as well.
Not for me, but that's because I vote super early, so let's see what happens.
It's so funny in 2020 I was online at 5:45 in the morning in Manhattan, and I was like the 17th person online. It was crazy how enthusiastic people were to vote at that election. See if it happens again this time. Thank you, Jake.
Thank you so much. Have a great rest of the week.
Jake Novak. Find him on Substack, jakenovak.substack.com. He's, of course, a brilliant political and economic commentator and a news and television producer for many, many years. Always gives us clarity. And it's good to have him sort of wrap up the feelings of what's happening in this country just a few days before the election.